Was there ever really a time when presidential campaigns lasted 6 months? When candidates hopped from city to city, kissing babies, shaking hands, and stem-whining over chicken dinners? Washington Post columnist Joel Achenbach isn't exactly nostalgic for those days, not exactly, but he does identify with Americans who are bothered by the new reality, endless flyover campaigns, the exploding expense. What does it mean for our democracy? Achenbach raises these questions in his article, Land of the Giants. It appeared in a recent issue of the Washington Post Sunday magazine, which, by the way, is one of our favorite places for interesting stories, big ideas, and just plain good writing. Joel, welcome.
Michelle, thanks for having me.
Joel, you write that these days, retail politics, the handshaking, the baby kissing, all that is really over. It's all about the media, and that means big donor events and basically touchdown leave. Are you just cranky, or is this something that's touched a nerve with a lot of people?
I am a little bit of a curmudgeon on this, perhaps, or maybe I'm just getting older, and I do sort of miss the days when candidates would go out there and meet real people, and the interaction between the candidates and the citizens was the main element of a campaign. Now, this, to some extent, is romanticizing the past. I realize there's always been smoke-filled rooms. Certainly the 40s and earlier, the nominations were decided by the power brokers. The ordinary citizens did not have a chance to say, I want the Democratic nominee to be so-and-so or the Republican nominee to be so-and-so. And then along about 1960, John F. Kennedy, I think, really did something remarkable, which is that he went out and he campaigned in Wisconsin for the Wisconsin primary. And here he is, a sort of, figure from Massachusetts, handsome, young, charismatic guy. But he did not – it was not clear that he was going to be the nominee. And he competed against Hubert Humphrey in the Wisconsin primary, and he was out there shaking hands at factory gates. He was, going into cafes and diners, going up and down Main Street in these little tiny villages in northern Wisconsin. And he proved that he had what it took to connect with people.
Did Kennedy, was he making a virtue out of a necessity, which is that he didn't have the party bosses locked up, so he had to come up with another alternative?
Precisely. And this is an interesting point today, because right now we have, everyone talks about the top-tier candidates and the second-tier candidates. And a legitimate question is, could a second-tier candidate, and that means someone who's not Hillary, Obama, or Edwards in the Democratic side, or on the Republican side, Giuliani, McCain, and Romney. Now, there's a bunch of other people running for president. In the old days, the idea was, if you were, say, Jimmy Carter, started in 1974, running for the presidency, and no one really knew him. He was a one-term governor from Georgia. But he was able to go to Iowa, and he, met essentially every human being in Iowa and probably a bunch of the cows and who knows. And he was able to build up enough support at the grassroots level to win the Iowa caucuses in 1976, and he was on his way to being the nominee. And the question is, does that old method, which is the retail method, one voter at a time, is it still possible to win that way?
But there are other forms of community now. I mean, the internet is one way that people can build community. Look at groups like MoveOn.org, many of whom, the people it seems were connected to or at least identified with the Howard Dean candidacy. Is that an alternative?
That's a great point. In my article, I raised the thought that perhaps, just what you were saying, that the internet is replacing the retail politicking as the place where the action is. And it's democratic. I mean, these are ordinary citizens who are able to support a candidate, give money. It takes place in cyberspace rather than in, Manchester, New Hampshire or Des Moines, Iowa. I mean, maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing that this time around there's going to be less importance invested in the very initial small states. That's Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada. The calendar is different. You've got California in the mix now, Florida, New York, Texas. They've all moved their primaries much earlier on the calendar.
Let's talk about this for a minute, because one of the reasons that some of these primaries started moving their primary dates up was that they got kind of irritated at being at the back of the line when they have more of the country's population, thing one. And thing two, that the Democrats moved up Nevada and South Carolina in part to get more diversity, to expose the candidates to different populations, to more minorities, for example. So I guess what I'm asking you is that really so terrible?
I think there's a lot of fairness to it because if you look at Iowa and New Hampshire, not only are they not representative of, you know, what America looks like, I mean, they're among the least representative. These are two lily-white rural states. I mean, there's not a big city in between, you know, in either Iowa or New Hampshire. I mean, if you've ever been to Manchester, you know, it's a nice city, but it's, you know, it's not Los Angeles. You know, it's not, you know, it's not Miami. And so I think that getting one of these more diverse states, one of the bigger states, into the mix, you know, there was a lot of logic to that. The nice thing about Iowa and New Hampshire, and the reason it has so much support, I think, among a lot of political professionals and people in my business, in the news business, is that the scale is small, so the candidates are accessible, and it seems to be about someone standing there in a school gymnasium answering questions from ordinary voters. At the scale of California, that doesn't happen. It's just going to be attack ads, or it's going to be, you know, a 30-second ad where someone comes up and says, this is why you should vote for me. It's not that California shouldn't have a say. It's that that's not necessarily the kind of politics that will give us the best leaders.
Why are you so convinced? And I understand you're not an advocate here. You're reporting the circumstances as they've unfolded in front of you. Mm-hmm. But why do you think that there's a connection between being a retail politician, high touch, really getting close to the voters, and showing what kind of leader someone is eventually going to be?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I in the story, I actually broached the possibility that what you get through retail politics is you may not get a great leader. You may get someone who's just good at retail politics. You may get someone who's really good at you know, schmoozing and who's glib and who looks good on the stump and who has the ability to
repeat the same daggone speech 17 times a day without it sounding canned.
And someone who, if you think about it, candidates, it is a grueling process. And so the point you're making, Michelle, I think is a good one. I mean, does it necessarily give us the best leaders? And I don't know the answer to that. My article, you know, I make the point, it's hard to picture George Washington, you know, as a retail politician. I can't picture George Washington and his various plans for America. I mean, he was a very good leader, a very smart guy and a strong guy, but he didn't like ordinary people that much. He was a terrible snob and did not like the rabble. I could not imagine him campaigning in these little small towns in New Hampshire saying, vote for me.
Joel Achenbach is a Washington Post columnist. He wrote about presidential campaigning in the Sunday magazine's May 20th issue. You can find it on our website at npr.org/tellmemore. Joel, thanks so much for joining us.
Great, Michelle. Thank you so much.